You're listening to another.
Happy Friday, everybody. Welcome to the Michael Cutler Hour. I am your host, Michael Cutler. It's July 24th, 2015, well past the midpoint of this year. So much going on and so many issues to discuss. I want to thank all of you for joining me at the end of the week to play that infamous game of catch-up, and there's certainly much to catch up on. Those of you who are familiar with me know that I'm a retired senior special agent with the Former Immigration and Naturalization Service, an agency whose mission was supposedly going to be taken over by Immigration and Customs Enforcement and Customs and Border Protection and a number of other agencies. But, of course, under this administration, the enforcement side of this program has been all but scuttled. But in any event, we're here to find out just how bad things are. I want to remind all of you about websites I'd love for you to go visit, my own personal website, MichaelCutler.net, one word, C-U-T-L-E-R, MichaelCutler.net, CAPS Web, C-A-P-S, CAPSWeb.org, Californians for Population Stabilization. In fact, I have a new article out on their website, Sanctuary Cities and Collateral Damage. I hope you go read it over the weekend. I will have a new article up on Monday that I also think you'll find interesting, along with a whole bunch of other folks who write for them. I write for Progressives for Immigration Reform, PFIR. Easiest way to find them. Front Page Magazine, The Social Contract, should have an article coming out this month, within the next week or two, in fact, where I am the lead story, and it's all about the nexus between immigration and terrorism, a topic that none of our supposed leaders seem willing to talk about. But I want to immediately cut short my usual discussion that I like to start the program with, because I'm very fortunate to have a friend, very patriotic American. Unfortunately, I know Don because we came to meet because of his son being tragically killed in California by an alien who had no license, who I believe, and I think he will agree with me, was shielded by the crazy sanctuary policies of San Francisco, where the accident took place, and by the state of California, which is really a sanctuary state. And, of course, now America has all but become a sanctuary country. So that's what today's focus is going to be on, about the sanctuary cities, sanctuary states, and what this really means to the real endangered species, not the criminal aliens that are being given sanctuary, but American citizens, decent people who are losing their lives because our politicians value their lives less than they value the political campaign contributions and these absurd promises of block votes if only they would betray their fellow citizens and their country. And unfortunately, there seem to be far too many politicians in both the repugnant can and the Democrat parties, as I've come to call them. So without any further ado, Don Rosenberg, happy Friday. Thank you so much for joining me. And I know you're going to want to talk about your trip to Washington, where you sat in on the Senate hearing earlier this week. So have at it, Don. The floor is all yours.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for having me on the show.
No, it's a privilege to have you.
Thank you. I was in D.C. For the Senate hearing on Tuesday, but let me back up a little bit as to how
sure.
I
Why
got
don't you
there.
Tell the audience briefly, in a 2 or 3 minute synopsis, your direct and unfortunate tragic involvement with this issue of sanctuary cities.
Sure. My son was a law student in San Francisco in 2010, and he was coming home to his apartment one night. He was on his motorcycle, but going very slowly. It was rush hour traffic. The traffic from the other side was very slow as well. And at the last second, a guy named Roberto Gallo, who had come into the country illegally in 1999, tried to make a last-second left-hand turn to beat the light. He collided with my son, who was in the intersection. Would have been okay had he stopped, other than maybe a few cuts and bruises, but he accelerated driving over my son's body. My son's helmet had come off and stuck under one of his tires, so it stopped him from going forward, so he backed up, driving over him a second time, and then trying to flee up the street that he was originally trying to turn onto. He went forward again. By that time, a guy had gotten out of his car and stood in front of Gallows, and he stopped, but his rear tire was on my son's abdomen, and they had to get five guys to lift the car off of him. You know, for all of that, he spent 43 days in jail.
American lives are cheap, aren't they?
They sure are. Take 50 years and pay back 43 days.
What country was this piece of trash from?
He was from Honduras.
So it's not just Mexico that we're talking about, is it?
No, I mean, clearly not. You know, I mean, look, I think it's over 80% come from either Mexico, Central America, and South America, so, which...
That's of the people that run the border, but not overall, because overall it's about 40% that enter through ports of entry through the lawful inspections process.
Right,
so these numbers are a little bit skewed. It's really... And, of course, we don't know what we don't know. Certainly Latin America counts for a lot.
Right, and we don't know the
point
know,
that I'm making, this isn't about a race. This isn't about singling out people by ethnicity, race, or religion. It's simply by making the distinction that you're either a citizen or you're not. And if you're not a citizen, the proper legal term that very few journalists, so-called, have the guts or integrity to use is that of alien, which simply means any person not a citizen or national of the United States. This has nothing to do with race, religion, or ethnicity. And that's the point that I want to hammer home. You know, when we hear this nonsense about the Latino vote, which is a disgusting form of profiling, we're missing the point. This is America's obligation to protect its citizens from people from other countries. I don't care if they're black, purple, green, or have yellow polka dots. I've arrested people from just about every country on the planet for violating immigration laws. So, you know, forgive me for jumping in, but I really want everyone out there to understand that we're talking about illegal aliens or aliens whose presence is against our laws, the laws designed to protect us. And now the protection is being afforded to the law violators and people such as your wonderful son and this woman Steinle, and there's, you know, it's daily. I mean, every single day, numerous people are losing their lives because of sanctuary policies in cities across the entire country. Wouldn't it be nice if American lives were valued as much by the politicians?
At this point, I'd be happy for half as much, because they're not valued at all.
No.
And I personally, to me, what country he comes from, other than just the statistic, is irrelevant. I mean, do I care who it is that killed my son? No, I only care that he was killed, and he wouldn't have been had the country enforced its immigration laws. That's all I care about.
No, I understood that he had an encounter with law enforcement for driving without a license previously, didn't he?
Yeah, well, what happened is, I mean, the irony in my case is very complicated compared to most, because the irony is he came into the country illegally. About a year later, there was a bad hurricane in Honduras, and he was given temporary protective status. I certainly have an issue with how temporary protective status, which is now going on 16 years for Honduras, it's not particularly temporary, and I don't know why you would reward somebody who broke the law with that moniker.
I have to ask you a question. Something just occurred to me. Do you know what kind of work this Cretan Gallo did for a living?
Odd jobs. He didn't seem to. I mean, after he killed Drew and then got out of prison, I hired I forget what they call it now, but somebody to follow him and
private investigator.
They had a different name, whatever it is, but to also record if he got into a car and drove, well, not if he got into a car, but if he drove a car. And, you know, the report back that I got, no, he didn't drive, but, you know, different people were picking him up different days and they'd go off to some, you know, some day labor kind of stuff.
All right, so here's my point. Exactly the words I was hoping you were going to say, because I didn't know. Now, I want everyone out there to think about what I'm about to say. I understand when there's a catastrophe in a country, a tsunami, an earthquake, a hurricane. Look, you don't want to take women and children and the elderly and shove them into a country that's unable to take care of them. I mean, look what happened in Haiti and so forth. But when a country gets demolished by a storm, what workers are in immediate greatest demand? Construction workers. So here's a guy who was doing work that related to construction in the United States, and we kept him from going home to do construction to build up his own country? I mean, is the irony not unbelievable?
Oh, yeah, he was clearly capable of doing that. I mean,
so that's my point. What were we protecting him from? We were protecting him from fixing his own country?
Yeah, obviously.
I mean, does that make sense to anybody out there?
Well, and we still are 16 years later. And we'll see, I guarantee you, next year they'll renew it for another 2 years. So, you know,
I mean,
this
is beyond belief.
Right, but what the temporary protective status got him, besides the ability to work, was the ability to get a driver's license.
Yep.
And we didn't know this until after the trial, but he failed the driver's test twice. And then in June of 2010, he got caught by SFPD driving the wrong way on a one-way street.
San Francisco Police Department.
Right. And, the police department was fine. They had to take him in because he couldn't get anybody to pick up his car, which was their policy. If somebody picks it up, they won't impound it. But he couldn't get anybody to do that, so they, took him in, impounded his car. He signed the title over to a friend, which is against the law. They went and picked it up 18 hours later. She gave it back to him immediately. 45 days later, he had his hearing about his, unlicensed driving and driving the wrong way on one-way street. They dropped the driving without a license and driving without insurance charges. And, basically he had to pay a ticket for driving the wrong way on a one-way street. And there he was off again driving. And plus the fact he'd been driving.
I mean, how brilliant do you need to be to figure out that when the other cars are all facing the other way, you're doing something wrong?
Right. Well, you know what? The sign probably, some signs are in symbols and some signs aren't. And I never went to look to see because I didn't want to. But the sign probably said, it was probably words that said, do not enter. But he can't read. He can't read or speak English after being in the country for 11 years. So he went down the street. Regardless, you would think that somebody who can get a license, has been in the country for 10 years, different states, failed the test twice in California, you catch him driving driving without a license, you wouldn't drop the charges. However, because San Francisco is what it is, they have a policy that, and they still have it even though you can now get a license, but their policy was if you're here illegally and you drive without a license, all is forgiven. Now, if you're here legally and you drive without a license, they'll nail you. But if you're illegal,
isn't that brilliant? So that, just stop and think about this. Chuck Schumer, one of the eight gangsters, the architect of architects of what they call comprehensive immigration reform, and I call the Terrorist Assistance and Facilitation Act, went before the cameras about 5-6 months ago. Hard to imagine Chucky in front of the cameras, right? And so he's standing there saying the reason people have been trespassing on the Brooklyn Bridge and the Manhattan Bridge and the Trade Center, the penalty isn't strong enough. It's a year in jail under New York City law. These folks aren't even getting 90 days in jail. This is why they trespass. And Chuck Schumer said, if you trespass on a landmark, it ought to be a federal offense with a 5-year jail sentence. So you climb that cable on the Brooklyn Bridge to get that artsy photograph of the Statue of Liberty at sunset, I'm going to put you in a cage for 5 years and we'll teach you a lesson. But when you trespass on the United States and we're at a time of war and we have a problem with criminals from around the world, that illegal entry, that trespass on America, now entitles you, I love those words, entitles you to a pathway to citizenship, the highest honor a country can bestow upon a foreign national. It just blows my mind that trespass on the bridge, he wants to put you in jail for 5 years. Trespass on America, you get the keys to the kingdom. This guy lacks mouth-ear coordination. His own ears don't hear the foolishness out of his own mouth.
It's absolutely, it is. It's mind-boggling. But anyway, so they do that. He then tries to take the test again. He fails it a third time. And again, I kept asking the DA's office. I said, something doesn't make sense. The guy's been in the country 10 years. He's got a California ID card, so he's not hiding from, you know, from anybody. He's owned a car for at least 3 years, because I had the records for when he purchased his car. Why doesn't he have a license? There's something wrong, and they refused to ever get me the information until actually the trial was over. I got it. Lied to me about how they couldn't get the information, which I then
the police
discovered.
Lied to you. The police lied to you.
No. This is the DA's office.
The DA lied to you.
The DA lied to me. Well, one of two things when it comes to his driving record, they either lied or withheld evidence. That's the only two choices, because I found out how easy it is to get the information. We got luck, if you want to call it luck. We got lucky at 4 weeks before the trial, the ADA on the case went on pregnancy leave, and we got a new guy, and the only person I dealt with in the DA's office, and this guy was fantastic. And after the trial was over, he said, yeah, I know you had asked me a question about, you know, his driving record, and then he told me, you know, he had two fails before and one fail after. I said, how hard was it for you to get that information? He said, I called up the DMV and they gave it to me. That's after the prior ADA said, first she said, I'm calling, and they won't respond. And then she said, then I called and they said they don't keep those records. Well, obviously that was a complete and utter lie. I believe that she had them, and because she knew how pissed off I'd be, that it took her so long and she ignored it. And although the evidence would not have been admissible in his trial, it would have been admissible in his preliminary hearing, where
and she
charge...
knew, and she knew that it was your 25-year-old law school student son who was killed by this cretin.
I can tell. I've told this story to many people. One, you know, one being Congressman Adam Schiff, and he sent me a little note. I sent him. He's not my congressman, but I was meeting him with somebody else, and I sent him a lot of the stuff. And he sent me a note back. The way your son's trial was handled, not my son's trial, the trial for it was handled in San Francisco was beyond. This is his words, beyond abysmal. And he made a couple of calls, and of course nobody wanted to talk to him either. And talking to different attorneys, and they've read the thing, every single one of them has said to me, if this had been a, you know, private law firm, you'd have five malpractice claims against these people. And I believe that at least two of them should be disbarred for their what they've done. And of course, what you hear all the time when you're talking about DA's offices, you know, they have immunity. And the line is, well, they have immunity so they can do their job. My feeling is, because they have immunity, they don't do their job.
Well, wait a minute. You have to ask yourself what they think their job is.
Well, as we said many times to them, why don't you sit second chair for the defendant, because you're sure as hell not helping me. And my wife said to them that she said, I can't believe that you guys are the prosecutors. And I'll tell you something. In this Steinle case, and I told Mrs. Sullivan, who's Kate's mom, I said, do not trust the San Francisco DA's office. They are not your friend. As long as George Gascon is there, I said, they are not your friend. And only because it's such a high-profile case, it's going to be hard for him. But I firmly believe that they sunk our case as much as they could on purpose. I mean, and I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but too many ridiculous things happened that should have never happened. I mean, I'll just tell you one. They filed an appeal. We have to fight with them to file an appeal on the preliminary hearing. Not only did they file it in the wrong court, but after they filed, we told them they filed it in the wrong court. I had a criminal criminal lawyer in Drew's school who was helping us a little bit. And when I sent her the stuff, she agreed. I mean, that was what public defender, his entire defense of the appeal was you filed in the wrong court. And she said, let me do a little research. A week later, she said, yep, they filed in the wrong court. We told them. They said, absolutely not. We know what we're doing. And even after the case was kicked, they never made an attempt to refile, which they could have easily done. They never even tried. All they wanted to do was get rid of this thing as fast as they could.
Well, you know, it's my understanding in the Steinle case that it was the prosecutors who sent the detectives over to take custody of Sanchez. It's almost as though they were figuring they were going to spring him.
I don't know, but all I know is that if it was up to me, George Gascon would be one of the defendants in the case, not the prosecutor.
But you see, that's what really needs to happen, because if you look at the law, and you know, you and I have talked about this frequently, but I can tell you that if you look at, and I'm going to get into a little bit of law here, folks, but if we keep speaking in generalities, it doesn't help educate anybody, and that's why I wish you'd go to the websites I always talk about, michaelcutler.net, capsweb.org, Front Page Magazine, The Social Contract, because what I try to do is provide you with enough information that when you speak to some of these slimy politicians, forgive the redundancy, you're armed with information. Title 8, United States Code, Section 1324, deals with harboring, aiding, abetting, shielding, smuggling, encouraging, inducing. Well, how in the world are sanctuary cities not guilty of all the above? You're encouraging people to come to the United States, because they know if they can slide into home plate, they're safe. Home plate are the sanctuary cities. By not letting ICE know that they have people in custody, they're harboring and shielding. And when detainers are ignored, I mean, this is a willful act. There's a piece of paper, and you've got the sheriff saying, well, you can't make a warrantless arrest. Absolutely you can. Immigration agents do it all the time. Most of the arrests that I made as a new agent were warrantless. You encounter somebody, there'd be a complaint that there was a factory where people were working illegally, and this is even before it became a crime for knowingly hiring illegal aliens, we would arrest the illegal aliens. So you would go in, even without a warrant, and very often the owner would say, yeah, you can talk to my workers, and you would question the person about their immigration status, how they came here, what country they were from, and so forth. It's known as establishing alienage and deportability. And then if the guy turned out to be an illegal alien, you put the handcuffs on him, and there was no warrant involved. It was a warrantless arrest, but only immigration agents have that authority. So when an immigration agent gives the jail a piece of paper called a detainer, and I've lodged a whole bunch of those, a boatload of those in my 30-year career, they're supposed to honor them. And so here you have a case where they have these detainers, they toss them aside and say, we don't care. Now, what's so frustrating is if you look at what the 9/11 Commission report had to say, and that's why I can't wait for this article to come out, it even addressed the routine enforcement of immigration laws. You know, Don, what amazes me is I always hear this, we're going after the bad guys and we're going to ignore the small fish. When I worked with Al D'Amato to create the Ag Felon Reentry Statute, the aggravated felon law, to make it a 20-year maximum penalty, I also said we should be prioritizing criminal aliens. In the old days, just to give people a little bit of background, your evaluation was dependent. Oops, I just dropped my microphone. Your evaluation was dependent on how many apprehensions you made, how many people you processed for deportation. So if somebody went into a factory and arrested a woman who had five children, he got credit for six arrests if all five kids were born outside the United States. And I thought this was kind of nuts. My partner and I tended to go after the criminals, so I might have only had three or four arrests for the month, but one guy shot a police officer, one guy was a suspect in a rape case, and so forth. Who would you rather get off the street? But I was very clear to D'Amato, and he agreed with the strategy, and so were the guys who I brought with me, because over a six-month period, over 30 of my colleagues eventually spoke to his staff. And we said, but we should not stop arresting illegal aliens who have no serious criminal histories, because you still need people to be fearful that if they're in the wrong place at the wrong time, they're going to get arrested. This is what deterrence is about. So you don't just say, well, I've never been arrested. Immigration's not going to be bothering me. That's not true. If I knocked on a door because I had a warrant to arrest somebody who was a known alien smuggler, and he moved out and some other guy moved in, I'd say to the guy, where are you from? And the guy would say, well, I'm from Guatemala, and I'm looking for a Mexican guy. Well, here's where the warrantless arrest comes in. How did you enter the United States? Well, I ran the border. Really? Do you have any passport? No, I don't. You're under arrest. Now, why did we do it? Two reasons. Number one, to maintain the system's integrity. But there's another reason. Do you know how many times I've arrested people, and then as you dig into the guy's background, you find out that he escaped from a penitentiary? You found out that he committed murder in his home country? See, when people run the border, you need to understand it's not normal for somebody who's middle-aged, 30, 25, 40, whatever, to up and run to another country where, you know, the language is dissimilar. It's a total new world. Why would you uproot yourself? Some people are just financially desperate. But you have a fair number of criminals who are on the run, and not just from Latin America. I've arrested people wanted in Australia for crimes, and they came all the way to the United States. I arrested a bunch of Israeli fugitives. One fugitive was wanted for murder in Israel. So understand that when people run that far at that age, uprooting themselves, there's a host of reasons why they might be doing it. So this notion that we're going to ignore people and ignore detainers, oh, it's only an immigration charge. Look at the 9/11 Commission report where they spoke specifically about the need for routine immigration enforcement, not targeting the bad guys, just routinely going about what you're doing so that the issue, and this is a legitimate term in law enforcement, kicks in, known as randomness. So that by the luck of the draw, whammo, you got the guy. Half the FBI's 10 most wanted get arrested, believe it or not, for motor vehicle violations. The guy's driving down the road, he blows a red light, he gets pulled over. I was involved with a case where they were about to be put on the 10 most wanted list, two guys from Trinidad. They were involved with a bunch of violent, deadly bank robberies. And how did they get bagged? Not by the FBI. They got grabbed by the New York City Police Department for running a red light. I got involved with the case. We ran the fingerprints to Washington, and lo and behold, there were fugitive warrants outstanding. So understand the benefit to routine enforcement. We've now taken immigration out of the equation. So we're now talking about international criminals, international terrorists, international fugitives, who can now breathe a sigh of relief and seek sanctuary in the United States by some pretty screwed up politicians. I mean, it blows my mind. It should anger everybody, don't you think?
Yeah, well, you know, and where it gets more complicated and where you say, I mean, perfect example, the guy Gallo, he, from everything we could see, I mean, we hired a private investigator. We couldn't find any, you know, that he had committed any other crimes prior to this. But I found out the afternoon that his deportation hearing ended, that his wife had a deportation order from 2006. And had she been deported in 2006, none of this would have ever happened because they were on their way to parenting class. And not the kind of parenting class you sign up for, the kind of parenting class you're ordered to go to by the court.
How badly do they mistreat their children?
Well, I don't know, because we kept looking at him and couldn't find anything. And now I feel, and I actually just thought about this the other day, and I'm doing some work to see if they can find it. I think it was her. I think she did something. The kids were 3 and 8 at the time that all this happened.
Wow.
So obviously you're not going to parenting class when your kids are that old. But the main point being that there's a lot of cases where the person who, you know, maybe is the one who actually committed the crime, in this case, he maybe shouldn't have been deported, but she should have been. And had she been, this would have never happened. So it can be very tricky, which comes back to your point. That's right. You can't just say, oh, let's just, you know, target the worst of the worst and let anybody else go, because you don't know what's going to happen. And most of the traffic fatalities from people that are here illegally, the person isn't the worst of the worst. You know, they may be bad, they may have had some crime, but they're not the people like Sanchez who killed Kate Steinle. That's not the typical traffic offender. So,
PJ Media had a report about how many criminals are running loose in Texas that we turned loose. And you know what's so galling to me? If you go to the CNN website or the Wall Street Journal, oh, the Steinle case was an exception. This doesn't really happen. There's a handful of people. These are the illegals are the most law-abiding people in the entire country. They make American citizens look evil because they are so good and angelic, and they never do anything wrong. Why? Because the Wall Street Journal doesn't give a damn how many Americans die. In fact, I have to be cynical. Maybe they're happy to send some business over to the mortuaries and the undertakers and the funeral homes. You know, it's remarkable to me. I was sitting at an event in Florida with the David Horowitz Freedom Center, where I'm very proud to be a columnist. And I was greatly honored that Jeff Sessions, Congressman Louie Gohmert, and Congressman John Fleming joined me. I was one of the four. I mean, what an honor. These guys, you know, a senator, two members of Congress, and Mike Cutler. What am I doing there? And the four of us did a panel discussion on immigration. And it was remarkable because the following day, I'm sitting in this grand ballroom. There must have been 1,000 people there, maybe more. And who's speaking but a financial guy and a Wall Street Journal reporter, so-called. The Mexican border, there's no traffic, no one's coming, probably more people are leaving than are coming. We can forget about the Mexican border. And I'm sitting there stunned. Senator Sessions was sitting there stunned. What in the world are you talking about? They are surging across the border every single day. There's nothing to see here, folks. Keep moving. The border is under control. All we need to do now, because we really don't need the bottom rung people, and then they don't even have work because they're all going home on their own. We don't have to deal with them. But we do need to bring in hundreds of thousands of computer programmers because God only knows we just don't turn them out in this country. And Jeff Sessions jumped up and went nuts, and he said, wait a minute. They just fired 18,000 computer programmers in Silicon Valley. And I actually made the same point and referenced something that Alan Greenspan had said at a hearing for Schumer back April 30th, 2009, calling high-tech workers, programmers, and the like, the privileged elite earning a wage premium because they're not being forced to compete with foreign workers. And Greenspan said, we need wage equality. Think of all the politicians talking about wage equality. And how do you arrive at wage equality? You hammer the wages of America's skilled workers, meaning the people with the advanced degrees, the engineers, the technicians. You hammer them. You get rid of that wage premium by forcing them to compete with workers from all over the world. Once you get rid of the wage premium, you narrow the gap. You greatly reduce wage inequality between these people with advanced degrees and the high school dropouts. In other words, we are to kill the middle class. And that's what the Wall Street Journal is about. And when I made that statement, the guy at the Wall Street Journal was furious. I mean, he was livid. And you know, Jeff Sessions was in total agreement. We were on the same page. And I thought, goodness, to stand there, watch your nose grow, this Wall Street Journal liar, thief, immoral dirtbag, giving people misleading, wrong, false information, so that we can ignore the Mexican border, ignore the flood of narcotics coming in and the criminals. And you listen to this, and I have to tell you, I thought my head was going to explode. This is done willfully. And that's why I wrote an article for Front Page Magazine that I called, it was actually CAPS. Let me put credit where it belongs, Californians for Population Stabilization. And I called it Sanctuary Cities and Collateral Damage. Think of all the smart bombs that we use overseas in war so that we absolutely minimize collateral damage, civilian casualties, right? In the United States, no one cares about collateral damage. In the United States, it's the cost of doing business. I had worked with some folks at the 9/11 Families for Secure America, and the founder of the organization, Peter, had said that the death of his son, also in his mid-20s, on 9/11, was the cost of doing business to people who don't give a damn about American lives. And we're seeing it with sanctuary cities. We saw it on 9/11. We're seeing it again. They don't care who dies as long as it's not them. And that's what we're witnessing. is the absolute disregard for American life today. Forgive my rant, but this makes my head want to explode.
At the hearing, well, actually, before I got
Why don't we get into the hearing, because I know your time is limited, and I really think my audience is going to want to know what you experienced in Washington.
Okay. Well, I was called a week before the hearing and asked if I would come and testify, and I said, sure. And then, you know, they said, well, you know, we're asking a lot of people. We're not sure how many we can have. If we can't, you know, have you speak, we'd still like you to come and submit written testimony, which I said I would do, although I wasn't really happy about that because I could see what they were trying to do, which was to frame this thing as the worst of the worst.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, if you do, and I even said to them, you know, if you do that, you're defining these crimes as few and far between by showing the most heinous ones. You should at least have one person who kind of fits the normal day-to-day people that are getting killed. But needless to say, they, you know, they wanted to do what they wanted to do. But I still went, and I had my written testimony. And, you know, so Tuesday morning comes. First, we have a meet and greet with the senators. It was, you know, the people that were testifying, the senators on the committee. Well, a couple of Republican senators came in, Grassley, Cruz, Vitter. Maybe there was one other one, I'm not sure. And the only Democratic senator that came in was Feinstein. And she really didn't have a choice because obviously she's from San Francisco and that's where, you know, where Kate Steinle was from. So, you know, I was, you know, you're all talking, whatever, and I had my back semi-turned talking to somebody else, and I didn't even know Feinstein was there yet. And she came in, and then I could hear her. She starts talking to Liz Sullivan, Kate's mom, and it was just one of those blubbery comments. I mean, I describe it as she's Cruella de Vil telling mm-hmm. the owners of the 101 Dalmatians how sad she is that someone has stolen them, even though she's the one who stole them. And I turned to her and I said, you know, hello, Senator Feinstein. My name is Don Rosenberg. My son was killed almost 5 years ago in San Francisco by an illegal alien, and a lot of it is your fault. And then I continued on. I said, so you helped create this problem. Now what are you going to do to solve it? And she gave me the dirtiest look, you know, you can imagine. And just
her phaser was not set on stun, I can assure you.
Yeah, and just as that happened,
on vaporize.
You know, the staff there said, come on, everybody, we got it. You know, the hearing starts. We got to get into the hearing room. And so we never had any more conversation, but, you know, off we went. So I sat, you know, peacefully but steaming behind the panel as they were all talking, you know, giving their testimony. And this one guy, a reverend from New York, and I have to tell you, I don't know if you have any religious listeners, but they're some of the worst people in this process because they seem to have a double standard over what their, you know, religious teachings make them, you know, what they should do. But anyway, so he starts testifying.
What was his name? Do you remember?
It was, you know, I'll tell you in a second. I do have it here. He was Reverend, I want to say Guido Sarducci, but I know that's
you're awful.
That's not it, although it would have been better had it been Guido Sarducci. Gabriel Salguero, and he S-A-L-G-U-E-R-O, and he happens to be in New York.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's typical for these people. They start off with the how sorry they are that, you know, people mm-hmm. have been killed, even though it's their policy and protection that helps that. And then he must have said, I'm praying for you, I'm praying, you know, all this stuff about 20 times.
Yep.
And of course, he's praying. And then he says, and, you know, I'm praying, but there's nothing else I can do. And of course, I'm thinking if you would just shut up, go home, and stay out of the whole process, that would be a big improvement.
Yeah.
So he then goes on to talk about, you know, and he's obviously there arguing that there should not be, you know, they shouldn't cut funds from sanctuary cities. So he basically does what all of these guys do. They try to turn those here illegally into the victims. The victims are, you know, are ignored, and these people are victims because people are, quote, out to get them. So he goes through all that.
The rapist didn't have a good experience when he was raping the girl, right?
That's right, right. It's how could she be so cold? So
exactly. So uncooperative. So uncooperative.
Right. He then makes a comment. It's like his closing comment where he says, "Please don't hurt the, you know, all the 11 million or whatever number he used that are here because of the few people who have been killed." Get that. The few people have been killed. And I
sat there. Hold that thought, but keep going, but I've got something to read to you when you're done. I got something for you that's going to knock you out.
All right. Well, I sat there steaming, and I let everybody finish. And then when they were done, you know, Grassley dismisses the panel. And there was another panel to speak, but there's a recess. And I walked over to this guy, and I said, "How dare you make the lawbreakers the victims and be so callous to my son who was killed and the people sitting up here whose loved ones were killed and everybody else by describing it as few? A few people? What's your definition of a few?" And he just starts, like, walking out and everything, and I lost it and just started screaming at him, "You're talking about thousands of people who have been killed, tens of thousands who have been killed by the people that you're protecting." At which point the Capitol Police grabbed me and took me out to the hallway, and then one of them came running out screaming, you know, "Cuff him and arrest him." And then they took me outside.
Disturbing the peace.
Well, it gets worse. They didn't arrest me. We talked for a little bit, and then they took the handcuffs off. But then I had to meet with the terrorism squad. Now, when I say terrorism squad, I don't know what their exact name was, except terrorism. Something was in the, you know, in their description.
Well.
And, you know, we talked for like 15 minutes, and, you know, I have to say, I mean, the police were all fine. I can't complain one bit about any of these people. They were very nice to me. And one of them, after, you know, as we finished, said, you know, "I'm really sorry we had to do this." And I said, "You know, don't apologize. You were doing your job. If only the rest of law enforcement would do their job, I wouldn't be here today." And they all agreed. I mean, we left as friends.
Yeah.
So, but here's the irony to that, and then I want to hear what you've got to say. But the irony to that is in May, you know, so here I am, 62 years old. I don't have any criminal record past maybe a parking ticket in my entire life, which is obviously not a criminal record, but as far as some transgression. And I'm spending 15 minutes with four people from the terrorism squad. In May,
After you were handcuffed.
In May, I'm testifying at a Los Angeles County Board of Supervisors meeting because they want to stop the Sheriff's Department from adhering to the 287G program. So for the listeners, 287G has to do with convicted felons, not misdemeanors, not infractions, not even somebody who's here illegally.
They
you
ended it
be,
in New York City. They ended
right. Well,
they kicked
ended
immigration
it,
out of Rikers Island, by the way.
They did the same thing here in Los Angeles County. So they don't even want somebody from ICE just to interview a convicted felon before they're let out of prison. But when they were doing this, they weren't detaining most of them anyway.
Right.
They don't want them to do that, but it's okay for me, an honest tax-paying, legal American citizen.
No, I mean, shame on you. If you're dopey.
But I have to spend 15 minutes with the terrorism squad.
Let me tell you something.
Because my voice got loud.
Let me tell you something. And by the way, I know that I think it was Kate Steinle's mom who talked about the members of the Senate who fell asleep during the hearing while these heartbreaking.
I think that was Sabina Durden, whose son was also killed. Yeah.
Who was the dotting idiot? The dozing idiot.
I don't. You know. I mean, I didn't see that. I did see a lot of people, you know, texting and checking their email and everything. But to me, I was more angry at, you know, Dick Durbin and your good friend Chuck Schumer. They came in very late. They listened for about a minute when one of the first person testifying was the uncle of Grant Ronenbeck. He is the 21-year-old who was shot in the face in Arizona last year because he didn't count the change fast enough to give some thug his cigarettes. So he shot him in the face, jumped over his body, and just grabbed a couple packs and walked out. So they got up and left because they didn't want to hear that. And they never came back. They didn't want to hear any of the stories that people had to say. That disgusts me more than anything.
So if you want to talk about an inconvenient truth, that's the inconvenient truth. And here's the thing. Do you know, and this goes to Reagan. Under the Reagan administration, and my conservative friends always say, well, Reagan always said that the amnesty was the biggest mistake. Not. Listen, he was the commander-in-chief. He knew that we got into this mess of illegal immigration, and it wasn't nearly what it is today, by a lack of agents. He hired virtually no special agents. By coming up with the employer sanctions law that created the illusion, oh, we're going to get tough on the employers, which we were all happy about because I love going after employers who exploit people. But what happened? We didn't have the agents. So you've got millions of employers. You had a handful of agents. This simply gave more work to the agents who couldn't deal with the workflow as it was. I mean, this has always been Lucy at the Bonbon Factory. But one of the other provisions that many people don't know about of the amnesty of 86, we were not allowed to share those amnesty files with anybody for any reason under any circumstances unless a judge issued a court order. And Kennedy employed it, and Reagan signed off on it. And it said that it is a felony, so that if, and it happened to me, if an FBI agent came and said, we're looking for somebody who's killed three or four people, we're afraid they will kill more people, do you know where the guy lives? I said, yes, I do. Where does he live? I can't tell you. And the bureau agent, and he was there with a homicide detective, his jaw dropped. He said, what? This guy's going to kill people. I said, go find yourself a judge. He said, I don't understand. He said, where is the information? I said, on the file folder on my desk, but if I give it to you, I can go to jail. I will certainly lose my job, my pension, and my ability to support my family. He said, why? I said, it's the law that the Reagan administration signed into law. And he went crazy. He said, people may die as a consequence. I said, well, it's either that or I lose my job. I need my job.
Well,
what do you do in a set of circumstances like that? Now,
I don't know.
Understand, this was what that's what Reagan signed into law, and they also gave the illegal aliens free lawyers. If you came legally, by the way, because we had those two, if the FBI came and said, we need the file, you would run like a track star, race to the file room. It was a different world, and everything is done electronically. Grab the file, run downstairs out of breath, jumping over people. Here's the file. But if there was anything in the file where he had applied for amnesty, there was a red sheet. You could not pick up that red sheet under fear of going to jail for 5 years. Now, think about that. We gave the illegal aliens who applied for amnesty a level of protection that we would never give an American citizen or a lawful immigrant. And then the Bush administration came in, and Michael Chertoff had a brain fart. Because, you see, the Privacy Act was enacted, I believe, because of Senator Church's hearings about abuses by the intelligence agencies. This happens periodically. They overreach. They violate their charter. And they said, oh, this is terrible. And then you had Nixon with the political enemies list. He could only dream what Obama's doing with the IRS now. And they said, well, you know, the privacy laws will protect Americans from disclosure. But the only people who were covered by the Privacy Act were United States citizens and lawful immigrant aliens, aliens with green cards. Aliens who came on tourist visas, work visas, whatever, they weren't protected by the privacy law. Illegal aliens, absolutely no protection.
Along
comes Chertoff and Bush, and what do? Bush signs an executive order that says every alien, especially illegal aliens, you must never divulge any information about them, period.
Yeah, the Privacy Act
by executive order.
Yeah, this Privacy Act explicitly and specifically excludes illegal aliens.
That's right. And it was so used,
it was
comes
used
along.
Against when we were trying to get Gallo deported. This, and this was a letter that went to a U.S. congressman, that we can't tell you what our decision will be. I mean, which they eventually did. They eventually said, well, we're not deporting him because he's only committed one crime of moral
turpitude.
Don't
you like the word only when your son's dead? How did that make you feel?
Well, I finally got him deported.
My blood is boiling
curious.
Just hearing it again from you, Don.
Well, because, believe me, I've said that to I said that to a lot of the senators the other day when I met them. I said,
it's a hell
you know,
of a freaking only.
Telling him my story, and I said, you know, only committed moral turpitude? Is that government speak for killing somebody? But here's, if you want to hear the hypocrisy of hypocrisy now in California. So, you know, most of this argument is over cooperation. There's obviously reasons behind it. You know, we shouldn't have to cooperate with the feds. Why do we have to cooperate with the feds? It costs us money to cooperate with the feds.
They're reimbursed.
Well, yes, but forget that for a minute. Well, last week, in a very unusual summer weather system, California had some massive thunderstorms and rain and some flooding. And because Jerry Brown was out of town last week, Gavin Newsom, the lieutenant governor, not only declared the state or portions of the state a disaster area, but he ordered Caltrans, the transportation agency in California, to go to the federal government and get money to repair the roads. So they won't cooperate with the federal government, but they sure can put their hand out quickly and say, give us money. It's like, you know, you couldn't write this and make it a fiction story. It's so absurd.
No,
Of course, they'll give them the money, but I wish they just told them, you know, to go to hell.
But now, so now look at the incompetence of our federal government, by the way. One of the pieces that I included in my article about terrorism, do you know that the Witness Protection Program, I call it the Witless Protection Program, gave new identities to terrorists and then did not tell the people who put together the no-fly lists? I kid you not. I feel like Johnny Carson and Ed McMahon. How bad is it? That's how bad it is. There's another quote, and then I want to read a statistic to you about crime, because this will blow everybody away, I think. But as I'm sitting here, I'm looking to see if I can find, because the 9/11 Commission was so crystal clear about the need for routine enforcement of our immigration laws, which makes sense. It's not an only trespass. If someone breaks into your house and the guy says, oh, I only wanted a glass of water, you're going to take him at his word? I mean, what in the world are we talking about here? But you have the 9/11 Commission talking about the need for routine enforcement, and these people are absolutely in violation of all those findings and recommendations, and the result is that we are threatening national security, even as ISIS is on a rampage, even as they hold hearing after hearing talking about how, there's concern that we're going to be attacked. It doesn't much matter. So here is... here's what I wanted to read. Okay. Although there is evidence, this is from the 9/11 Commission staff report on terrorist travel. Although there is evidence that some land and sea border entries of terrorists without inspection occurred, these conspirators mainly subverted the legal entry system by entering at airports. How many times have I talked about this?
Yeah.
In so doing, they relied on a wide variety of fraudulent documents, on aliases, and on government corruption. Because terrorist operations were not suicide missions in the early to mid-1990s, once in the United States, terrorists and their supporters tried to get legal immigration status that would permit them to remain here, primarily by committing serial or repeated immigration fraud, by claiming political asylum, and by marrying Americans. Many of these tactics would remain largely unchanged and undetected throughout the 1990s and up to the 9/11 attack. Now, here's the key paragraph, folks. Understand, they're looking for lawful status, which is what all these members of Congress want to give them with comprehensive reform. And there's so many people, there'd be no face-to-face interview and no field investigations. So here's the last paragraph that really sums it up. Thus, abuse of the immigration system and a lack of interior immigration enforcement were unwittingly working together to support terrorist activity. It will remain largely unknown since no agency of the United States government analyzed terrorist travel patterns until after 9/11. This lack of attention meant that critical opportunities to disrupt terrorist travel and therefore deadly terrorist operations were missed. And there's even another paragraph that speaks specifically to the need for routine, mundane, everyday enforcement of the immigration laws. We've had naturalized citizens become members of the most wanted list of terrorists. I mean, on and on and on. But now, here is something that was on PJ Media, and I got this from my friend Bobby Gunther Walsh's radio show I do every other Friday. I was on with Bobby this morning. He emails this to me. I don't know if this name is familiar to you. J. Christian Adams. J. Christian Adams was a DOJ lawyer who blew the whistle and resigned from the Justice Department when the Black Panthers blocked white voters from voting in Pennsylvania. Do you remember that travesty?
Yeah, yep.
And he was so angry at what Holder did, he said, "I can no longer work for the Justice Department," and he quit. Here is the headline from his article, J. Christian Adams, Rule of Law, PJ Media has posted the story July 22nd, just 2 days ago. Illegal alien crime wave in Texas. You ready for this number? 611,234 crimes, 2,993 murders since, I believe it was, yes, this is from October 2008 until April 2014. And he says Texas identified a total of 177,588 unique criminal alien defendants booked into the Texas county jails, identified as through the Secure Communities Initiative, in which Texas has participated since 2008.
That's just the ones that were caught.
Just a few people.
Right.
A handful.
Minor.
Well,
few,
maybe
right.
compared to the world population, 177,588 are a handful.
As the good reverend says, just a few.
I mean,
well,
does that
not
blow your mind?
Well, yeah, and I'll tell you, I was not, you know, one of the problems also is, you know, where is the Republican Party when it comes to allocating more money? These guys keep saying we have limited resources. So, good.
By the way, here's the other number. Those 177,000 are responsible for at least 611,234 individual crimes, including 2,993 homicides, almost exactly the number we lost on 9/11. And 7,695 sexual assaults over a six-year period.
Oh, didn't go over 8,000? Doesn't count.
I mean, what in the world needs to happen? So now here's my question to my audience, and I know you guys are listening, so I know you're interested, and I'm sure many of you are activists. You're not doing enough. I'm not doing enough. Because we have too many Americans that are still playing with their Xbox or something. We got to wake up, folks. This isn't about xenophobia. This isn't about racism. And I can tell you from personal experience as an agent, when you talk about ethnic immigrant crime, and I'm not just talking about Latinos. We're talking about the Russian mob, Asian organized crime, the Jamaican posses, the African gangs, the Somali gangs, European gangs, the Middle Eastern characters. I've arrested them all. My last significant arrest was a Mario Cuban wanted for murder one in Chicago. Okay? It's not Mexico. It's not one part of the world. It's the planet. When you look at the level of crime, the one thing that sticks out is that almost invariably the majority of the victims are members of the same ethnic immigrant communities because that's where the crimes are taking place. Whether it's the brothels, whether it's the drug trafficking, whether it's the extortion. You know, so it's not just that we're saying, well, this is non-white against white, so this is, no, there's no race component. I know Obama likes to throw race around. I know Obama went to prisons, and he's releasing drug dealers, say drug trafficking is not a violent crime. I'd love to have had him go out on the street with me in the days when I was doing the drug raids. Almost inevitably, when we hit a location that had narcotics, they had guns. And I remember one day, I had a desk at the FBI and DEA and ATF. I had three walkie-talkies in addition to my immigration walkie-talkie. I had a radio call sign for each of the agencies. I had a DEA identity, and I had security badges. I had an FBI identity with an FBI security badge, and I had one for DEA as well. So I was kind of like, who do I want to be today? And one day, my friend Billy Fredericks, who was the supervisor of the ATF group that I was assigned to, calls me up and says, we're going to do a raid tonight. You want to come out and play? I said, sure. And about 30 minutes later, I get called in by my FBI supervisor, and he said, Mike, we're short people. You haven't been out with us in a couple of weeks. We're executing warrants. We got the NYPD on board. We need you to come out. I said, okay. So I call up my buddy over at ATF, and I said, Billy, I can't come out and play. He said, what's wrong? You got to do your homework? I said, I got to do my homework. We both joked about it. I said, let me know how you make out. He said, no problem. Well, that night when everything got wrapped up, I get a call on my ATF walkie-talkie. I'll never forget it. He said, so how'd you make out? I said, well, we grabbed, I don't know, 5 kilos of heroin, and we arrested 7 people, and we took a machine gun out of the house. Then he starts laughing. He says, small change. I said, small change? I said, you can beat that? He said, yeah. He said, we had to call the bomb squad. We had a couple of live hand grenades. True story. So we have the President of the United States, the Commander-in-Chief, acting more like a crime boss, lionizing drug dealers who are in prison, saying these aren't violent criminals. How much violence is related to the drug trade? Tons of it. Whether it's the addict who's so desperate for the money that they commit violent crimes, or the women that get involved in prostitution, or the guys that commit the burglaries to get the money. These folks are desperate for their fix, all because of the influx of drugs. And when they tell us the borders are secure, what you need to know is we've never had more heroin flowing into this country than today under this alleged misleadership by this administration. That's where the real numbers are. You know, they play with those statistics. The arrests are down, the arrests are up. I was on with Neil Cavuto. He said, well, if arrests are down, that means there's fewer here. I said, or they're not doing their job, or they're kept from doing their job, or they're fudging their numbers. I said, Neil, trying to figure out how many illegal aliens are present by looking at arrest statistics is like taking attendance by asking people not present to raise their hand. It doesn't work. How's that for an image? But yep. I said, if you really want to know if the border is secure, look at the price and availability of heroin and cocaine. We do not produce a gram of either of those toxic poisons inside our borders. Every gram of those substances is clear evidence of a failure of border security. It is so bad, there's a new article out. I thought we had hit rock bottom when they were talking about police departments across the country giving most of the officers the antidote to heroin overdoses. It's gotten worse. Guess who's now getting the antidote to heroin overdoses?
Who?
You ready?
The drug dealers?
No. You ready for this one?
Yeah.
School officials.
Oh,
and so
boy.
We're being told that drugs are not violent, you know, and the damage is greatest in the minority communities. The violence is greatest. Everyone is screaming about, how many bullets are you putting in your gun? You know, oh, you can only put 7 bullets in your magazine in New York unless you're retired law enforcement. Okay. However, terrorists, gangsters, crazy people, bank robbers, they don't count how many bullets they put in their illegal gun. Okay. If you want to go after the violence, go after the gangs, and much of the gang activity are aliens. You want to go after the violence, go after the narcotics. So you have the president not only releasing terrorists out of Guantanamo, because I'm willing to bet anything, and I hope I'm wrong, but I put nothing past this wacky administration, that before he's out of office, he will give Guantanamo back to the Castro brothers. I'm willing to make book on it. See, and he has a dementor to follow. Remember, Jimmy Carter gave back the Panama Canal, so he wants to copy his hero, the peanut farmer, and he's going to give back Guantanamo to Cuba. I hope I'm wrong. I'm hoping I'm wrong. But everything that this administration has done has been so much against our long-term best interests. I just absolutely have given up hope that this guy will do anything in our behalf. You look at the Iran deal. And I know you need to leave, but And but I'm going to talk about how Iran is operating inside this hemisphere. And you listen to the talk shows, and they'll be on spewing this Sunday, I promise you. And do you know, last week, one of these talking heads was running his mouth and saying, well, the American people don't have much to worry about a nuclear Iran. They don't have missiles. Well, first of all, they do have missiles, and they're building bigger missiles. And Russia is helping them. And Russia, I think, has missiles. I might be mistaken, but I think they have a couple of missiles.
Yeah, I think so.
I think we actually ride their missiles into space these days, the Soyuz. But the point of the matter is, you have Iranians arriving every week through Caracas, Venezuela, and these are the Iranian shock troops. How hard would it be to bring along a backpack nuke if, in fact, that's what they put together, God forbid? So I hear this nonsense. Oh, there's nothing to worry about. They're on the other side of the planet. The sun is going to shine. Everything is under control. No, it's not. And our safety and the survival of our nation hangs in the balance. And, you know, you don't have to die in a terrorist attack. Look what happened to your son. A quote-unquote ordinary motor vehicle accident. The carnage is beyond belief. And when an airplane crashes and a couple hundred people die, it makes headlines. And they spend millions of dollars trying to recreate the accident to make certain it doesn't happen again. The fact that thousands of Americans are being killed by people who shouldn't be here, that's a problem that's too difficult for us to figure out because it involves actually enforcing our immigration laws. And God only knows, we don't have that capability.
Of course, they want to invite
more.
Have
I lost my mind, Don? Forgive me for going off on a rant, but the more I think about it, the more infuriated I get.
Well, it is. I'm infuriated as well, and
Oh, I know you are.
Keep doing what I'm doing, and hopefully there'll be some breakthrough. Unfortunately, you know, look, we got a second life because this poor girl lost her life. Because otherwise, I mean, this argument's practically over.
And there's another publicized double homicide. Some dirtbag apparently got angry at his wife, another illegal alien. And
oh, he beat her to
death
with a
hammer. And the baby and the child, yeah.
Yeah.
It's endless. And meanwhile, everyone is sitting, oh, let's have another hearing. Let's have another conversation. Let's pass another law. Never mind that the law that we worked on when I was with Al D'Amato to put these bums away for 20 years max. We need the agents. We don't need another law. I guarantee you, folks, appropriations will not find the money. Will not. When I was sitting in the back of a limo with Mike Chertoff, it was probably the longest 45 minutes of his existence. Where do you want to get the money from? I said, well, you look at the $200 billion being wired out of our country by foreign workers. If you could stop the illegals from working and their flow of money coming out of our economy, we'd save money if you hired 30,000 immigration agents and actually allowed them to do their job. What
on
a
that
thought
note,
that
Mike,
would be. What
I've
a thought.
Go.
I'm going to let you go. Don, I really want to thank all of you. Is there a website that you want to put out there? Or
well,
anything?
You know, I will tell you. I mean, my website, I'm a one-man show, and it hasn't been updated
like.
In a long time.
I know
but
what
there is,
like.
There's some good information. There's good information out there. It's unlicensedtokill.org, which actually just right off the bat shows you it had really nothing to do with immigration when I started it. It just had to do with unlicensed drivers.
And
but
by the way, do you remember the argument that we had when I first introduced myself to you?
Yeah, I you're right. I was wrong.
No, that's not why I'm saying it. Because nobody wants to confront the fact that at root cause, as engineers will tell you, where did the system first fail? Was it the driver or was it the fact that they were actually in the country? And the bottom line is if we could have kept them out of the country, that's the ounce of prevention.
Right, but you got to remember we were told that he was here legally, which is why I didn't start with the illegal aspect of it. To me, I just started, you know, researching unlicensed driving and found what I found, which was both people in the country legally, citizens, and obviously a huge portion of people here illegally, but you know, it wasn't solely one problem. But anyway, Mike, let me thank you for having me on, and of course, I'll love to come back.
Absolutely, you're always welcome here. Let me tell you.
Thank you, and if anybody wants to reach me, if you go to unlicensedtokill.org, there's you can get an email from there, or it's unlicensedtokill@gmail.com, and love to hear from people. So thank you, Mike.
John, thank you for all the hard work that you're doing. Really, it was, I'm indebted to you for your dedication after this horrific tragedy for your family.
Well, I'm trying to save somebody else so Drew's life wouldn't just be a throwaway.
There was no throwaway. There was no throwaway.
No. Thanks again, Mike, and
okay,
we'll talk.
Was that a member of Congress barking in the background?
No, that was my dog, who's smarter than any member of Congress.
Probably so.
So.
Don, thank you. My best to your family. But stay with me, folks. Don, I will speak with you hopefully over the weekend. Stay well.
Okay. Thank you. Take care, Mike.
Okay.
Thanks for listening.
No.
Bye-bye.
Glad to have you. Bye-bye. Well, that was Don Rosenberg. I mean, it's a heartbreaking story. How in the world could you not be moved when you hear what happened to his family? And what's so incredible is this stuff is preventable. This stuff is preventable. If you want to give the politicians in Washington or elsewhere apoplexy, pull out the 9/11 Commission report and just ask them a simple question. Why aren't you using that report as the starting point for any conversation about immigration? You see, but the problem is that enough of our own fellow Americans are asleep at the switch. My dad used to tell me that I would teach people how they should treat me by demonstrating what I was willing to accept. And most Americans don't say a word. And when you dare talk about immigration, the allegations and the accusations fly. Oh, my God, you're a bigot. You're a racist. This has nothing to do with bigotry or racism. We need to grow a spine as Americans. We need to stand our ground. I'm not talking about firearms. I know there's been controversy about the stand your ground law on firearms. We need a stand your ground policy where confrontation by the open borders anarchists are concerned. People are dying because our government is corrupt. I mean, I sit here and I marvel at the fact that our immigration laws were enacted for two primary purposes: protect innocent lives and protect the jobs of American workers. And protect national security. Let's throw that into certainly not inconsequential. Those are the three objectives behind the law. You have politicians who get up there, I'm running for dog catcher, I'm running for the Senate, I'm running for the bathroom, wherever the hell they're running. And everyone promises, I'm going to help create jobs. But what they don't tell you, and what we're being lied to about, is that we are now admitting each and every month many more authorized foreign workers than the number of new jobs that we're creating. So even if every last job that these people promised to create gets created, more Americans will still be unemployed. Our economy will still lose more money as more foreign workers send their money out of the economy, as American workers lose their jobs and go from middle-class tax-paying homeowners with money to spend and their consumers, they wind up living below the poverty line, losing their homes, forcing the price of housing down, and going from consumer to not being able to spend any money, and then relying on expensive safety net programs. How does this help America? And when you listen to the programs this weekend, and I don't care what network you turn to, I don't care, spin the dial. It's like playing spin the bottle. Spin that dial. And they're all going to say the same thing. If they would only fix immigration, if they would only pass comprehensive reform, the economy would take off. I was on a radio show not long ago, and the young lady whose program I was on said to me, Mike, when they say the economy will take off, do you think that's a wrong statement? I said, no, it's an accurate statement. Well, she was kind of startled. Well, wait a minute, I thought you said there's a problem with this. I said, well, understand my reasoning. The economy, if they do this, will take off like a little bird fly into the wild blue, never to be seen again. That's how the economy will take off. Every foreign worker, and I don't blame the workers, they're doing what I would do. They're doing what's rational. Our government is doing what's irrational. If you could go to Canada, and let's say your normal paycheck is $100,000 a year, if you could do the same job in Canada for $400,000 a year, and you could do it legally, tell me you wouldn't go to Canada. Now, what would you do with all that money? Most people would send it back to the United States. How would that help the Canadian economy? And the answer is it would destroy the Canadian economy. We are destroying the American economy by bringing in the foreign workers whose goal is to send more money out of the economy. And if you go to the World Bank website, if you go to the United Nations website, they talk about two ways that the flow of money out of the United States could be greatly speeded up, and they want this desperately. They want to loot this country. Wow, you have no idea. Let's loot America because that money goes to the third world, and between the corruption and everything else, wow, we want that money out of the United States. And you know the two fastest ways the United Nations said it, and it may have taken it down since then, but sustainability and passing comprehensive immigration reform. The two fastest ways to amp up by tens of billions of dollars each and every year the amount of money flowing out of the U.S. economy. So what we're really talking about is the looting of America. It's like when people buy up a distressed department store chain. We had that happen in New York many years ago. It was called EJ Corvettes, and it was a bunch of Korean War vets, and that's what the EJ Corvettes was from. They were war vets from the Korean War. And these guys, eventually the company was in trouble. I think they had either passed away or retired, and they sold the company to some French outfit. I believe it was a French outfit. And they basically looted the store. They just sold off the assets. They did what they had to do. And within a matter of months, all those people who had worked for that store for a lifetime were out on the sidewalk looking for new work. They looted the store. The looting is now happening to the economy of the United States of America. And you have the talking heads, and you'll hear them Sunday. Watch them. There's one guy who I promise you will come on and talk about how, you know, every CEO demands more workers because we have these thousands of jobs and we don't know anybody that we can put in those jobs. If you go to the headlines, ladies and gentlemen, those are the same companies like Intel who are firing people. If you have a shortage of workers, do you fire people? I mean, this is common sense. If you don't have enough workers, why would you fire the people you have? You fire them because you want to replace them with cheaper labor. This is no different from the guy that hires illegal aliens to mow lawns instead of college kids because he knows he could pay the illegal alien a dollar an hour less than that college kid. Never mind that the college kid needs the money to get a degree, although now I don't know why you need a degree because you're probably not going to get the job anyway unless you're very lucky. We're operating against the best long-term interests of America and Americans to placate people that are simply engorging their pockets with American money, with the middle class wages. You know, no one seems to be able to figure this out. Watch the talking heads. If it wasn't so tragic, it could almost be funny that these people could be that damn stupid, because they're not that stupid. Or maybe they are. Maybe they are. I'd like to know if maybe they flunked the wiggle test. You know, you stick your left finger in your left ear, your right finger in your right ear, and they wiggle their fingertips, and if the fingertips touch, they flunk the test. How could you not understand that if you keep bringing in more foreign workers and the number of new jobs you're creating, that you're going to displace Americans? You're going to bring in foreign workers whose goal is to send money out of the economy. We were sold this notion of an economic stimulus package, you know. We're going to mortgage our future so we can pump money into the economy so that people will have jobs because people will buy stuff, and the people that sell the stuff will have more money and they'll buy more stuff. And that's called the multiplier effect, okay? When money comes out of the economy, it's the reverse process. It stops everything dead in its tracks. It's throwing a crowbar into a gearbox. But nobody cares because the super wealthy who have bribed the politicians with campaign contributions are ecstatic because God only knows when you're worth $25 billion, you're so desperate for money, you need more money, especially if you can take it from other people. And it's astonishing to me. And when you listen to the Democratic Party, it's both parties, folks, the Democrats and the Repugnant cans. And so you've got the Democrats saying, well, we want wage equality, $15 an hour, you know, $10 an hour. $10 an hour, folks, works out to $20,000 a year. $15 an hour works out to $30,000, give or take a couple of bucks. Equal to whom? Bill Gates, who's worth $60 billion? Really? Income equality? And nobody seems to say, wait a minute, what does a $15 an hour minimum wage have to do with that? And the answer is, it has nothing to do with it. They mix two things together and tell you that this is how it works, and everyone scratches their head and say, oh, I'm all for giving people $15 an hour. Well, you know what? So am I. Of course, the greedy bums that can't see beyond the profit law, oh, we can't do that. We should be able to pay less money. Then we'll create more jobs. This is a level of greed I've never seen before. I'd like to see somebody live on $20 an hour. I was in Florida. I'm sorry, I was in Washington a couple of years ago to speak at an event sponsored by Progressives for Immigration Reform, or an offshoot, the Black American Leadership Alliance. It was a D.C. March for Jobs. And some guy came up to me, and he said, you know, you're not going to like me, Mr. Cutler, but I've seen you on TV, and I have my own company in Florida. And I'll have you know that I have a bunch of illegals working for me. And I also hire some people to get out of jail. I said, well, that's a nice thing to do, to try to help these guys get a start in life so that maybe they don't go back to jail. He goes, yeah, well, they're willing to work, and the illegals are willing to work, but you can't get Americans to work. Now, this was July 15th, 2013. It was about 100 degrees, maybe more, in Washington, D.C., and I looked around, and there were all these construction workers, all these high-rise buildings with those huge cranes up there. And my dad, may he rest in peace, is a construction worker. So to this day, I can't walk by a construction site without thinking back to my dad, the sights, the sounds, the smells of the earth being turned. It's a very unique experience, and it brings you back to my childhood. It's a great memory. And I looked at all these guys, and they were up there, and they were sweating into their socks, over 100 degrees, and these guys were hammering away. And I said, look at these workers. He goes, yeah, but you know what they pay them here? I'm not going to pay that kind of money. I said, well, what do you pay your workers if you can't get any? He said, I pay up to minimum wage. I said, up to minimum wage? I said, you got the floor confused with the ceiling. Minimum wage means you're not supposed to pay less than that, not that that's the most you pay. He said, I pay him what I can get away with paying him. I said, well, how would you live on $10 an hour or $8 an hour? He said, oh, I would just take three jobs if I had to. I said, okay, so you do the math. Let's say you don't sleep, you don't eat, and you don't go to the bathroom, and you work 20 hours a day. How much money does it still amount to if you're making $8 an hour? He said, that's their problem, not mine. It was infuriating. It was infuriating. And I said, you know something? You need to think about General Eisenhower and the Allied forces during the Second World War. I said, who do you credit with D-Day more? The generals who had the brilliant strategy so that we could ultimately defeat the Nazis by coming in through Normandy? Or those poor soldiers who laid down their lives, or the ones who didn't die came home missing body parts? I said, you tell me who you give credit to, the generals or the soldiers. I said, because for me, it was a shared credit. Without the brilliance of Eisenhower and the other generals, there would have been no D-Day. But without those soldiers willing to lay down their lives on behalf of our nation, their plans wouldn't have succeeded. I said, in corporate America, I certainly want anybody who can come up with a great idea for a company to be as successful as possible, to live the dream. They put their life's work into this, their blood, their money, their inspirations, their hopes. I get that, and they should be rewarded if they're successful. But when the factory opens its doors, if you don't have dedicated employees busting their tail for the employer, it's not going to happen. Now, certainly, I don't think a guy working in a factory is going to make what the owner of the factory makes. That's crazy. But goodness gracious, how about showing some respect for the people that bust their butt for you? And, of course, he had no answer. And I didn't realize it, but a crowd had formed around me, and they started cheering when I said that to him. You would think this is common sense. You would think it's common sense. If people are going to go to work and dedicate themselves to working, then they need to be rewarded so it makes sense. No one's going to go to a job where when they get their paycheck, they still can't put the lights on or have a television with at least a cable box or something. You know, I mean, that's not the way people should be living. There's got to be fairness to all of this. And we're looking at a level of greed where people that fly around the world on their private airplanes and jets and yachts and 15 mansions and, you know, okay, you've been successful, that's fine. But at some point, you have to look around and say, my fellow Americans, the folks that work their tails off, they should live a decent life. And looting the American economy weakens us militarily. Read The Art of War by Sun Tzu. He was very clear about what happens to countries that run out of cash. They're doomed. All of this outflow of cash is undermining our ability to defend ourselves. And it's not as though waiting in the wings are Canada, Germany, or Great Britain. Waiting in the wings, ladies and gentlemen, is Russia, China, Iran. What could possibly go wrong? You know, we really have got to become involved. Everybody in America, given the seriousness of the situation, should be an activist today. I didn't start out planning to be what some people have called an activist. I was a federal agent. I enforced the immigration laws for 30 years. And in the process of enforcing those laws, and in the beginning, I didn't think immigration was as significant as I came to understand it really is. But once I realized what was at stake, and I looked at my own four kids, and now I have a granddaughter, and you look around at this country, and you see the soldiers coming home now from the Middle East, from Iraq, from Afghanistan. You watch the World War II movies, these young kids getting shot out of the sky. Some of those pilots were like 20 years old or younger. What did they die for? What did they sacrifice for? A country that our crooked politicians, forgive the redundancy, can't wait to give away with both hands? But you see, I blame us, we the people, for allowing them to get away with it. I have mixed feelings about Donald Trump. I mean, he's kind of a wild card. But I do respect the fact that he stands his ground. He's not looking at the polls every morning and looking over his shoulder, how are the polls reacting. From what I can see, he went out there and said, this is where I stand, this is what I believe. And even if you disagree with him, the guy is demonstrating a spine, or as we say in Brooklyn, chutzpah. Most of those politicians, the John Boehners of the world, you know, I think of a little puppy dog chasing a flashlight. You know, you shine the light on the floor and the puppy dog chases the light. That's how John Boehner is chasing a mythical Latino vote, which is really a discriminatory term. Latinos don't vote as blocks, the Jewish vote, the black vote. You mean to say if all I know is your skin color, your religion, or your last name, I don't need to know anything more about you because everybody is the same? Isn't that profiling of a disgusting degree? Everybody is unique. Everybody has a different perspective. And it takes a leader to unite people to understand the vision. It's not anti-immigrant to want the immigration laws enforced. Those laws are our first and last line of defense against criminals, against drug dealers, against terrorists, against our enemies. That's what this is about. And that's why when I listen to the debate, when I can listen to somebody like Dick Durbin, and boy, he's got the right first name, when I can listen to Dick Durbin, oh, you don't want to do harm to the people who are only here illegally. Well, if it's an only, then why are we spending billions of dollars a year inspecting passengers and cargo seeking to enter the United States? If it doesn't matter how you come here, why don't we simply allow the airliners who come here from other countries to just pull up at the gate next to the domestic arrivals? So the airplanes that are coming from Paris pull in next to the gate where the flight is coming in from Atlanta. And the airline that's coming in from Bogota, Colombia, pulls into the gate next to the flight from Boston. And the airliner that's coming in from the Middle East, same deal. From all over the... Why bother with an inspections process at the airport if it doesn't matter? If it doesn't matter that people are running the border and coming in without inspection, sneaking into the country, why do we have the charade at airports, costing a ton of money and slowing people down? Now, I know that the dirtbags at the Chamber of Commerce would say, let's get rid of the inspectors. I actually had a guy from the chamber tell me that that's what he wished we would do. We were both testifying at a hearing, and I turned purple when I heard what this guy said. So understand the problem. So what I ask all of you to do, please, get involved. Get involved, and please go to the town hall meetings. And when you hear a politician promise to help America lead by bringing in more foreign workers, you need to stand up and say just two words, citizens first. Citizens first. Maybe even have a little paper sign that says that. Our country is more about its people than the city's rivers and parks. It's the American people who really need to be represented. I thank you for joining me, folks. I look forward to having you join me again next week at the same time, same place, right here on the Michael Cutler Hour, where we will once again play that game of catch-up. Remember, folks, democracy is not a spectator sport. Have a great weekend, everybody.